Welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. We interview artists and entrepreneurs and explore things all storytelling. Explore all things storytelling. Today is going to be a very special episode because Chris has brought something that he wants to share with us today. So he often talks to me about it and it's something he's very passionate about. So I'm very excited to hear what he has to share today, and I hope that you can listen with an open heart and to, yeah, enjoy what Chris has to share today. So, Chris, off you go.
Well, hello, and thank you, Gemma, for agreeing to be an audience to this and to spar with me as we discuss some of these things. This happened in the late 1980s, around about 1987, 1988, in County Cleveland. And one of the things that's happened with the passage of time is that County Cleveland no longer exists. So for those who can't remember or weren't there at the time, the main city is Middlesbrough, and it also includes Stockton, Hartlepool, and Langbar, which is possibly the most obscure one, but that includes places like Redcar and Saltburn. And Hartlepool was always a thing to itself. It was always uncomfortable, and I think that's one of the reasons why the county doesn't exist anymore. So in those days, it was Stockton, Middlesbrough, and Langbar that tended to be closer together. And one of the signs of that was the Teesside Advertiser. And the River Tees runs through the middle of the county with the boroughs on either side. And the Teesside Advertiser went everywhere apart from Hartlepool. And I wrote a series of articles for the Teesside Advertiser. Now, I did that as a member of an organisation called Respond, and we always spelt it in capital letters with an exclamation mark after it, even in the middle of a sentence. And Respond was the church's response to Cleveland's industrial crisis. And there was loads of stuff going on all over the county, including in Hartlepool. And not only that, Respond was also built upon some other projects, most notably Impasse, but all sorts of other things that had been going on anyway and carried on under Respond, but were doing similar things. So we connected it all together. And my articles for the Teesside Advertiser were about projects for the unemployed, which turned out to be mostly woodwork shops. And I became brilliant at writing completely different articles about woodwork shops. But this particular edition or article that I wrote was on a very different sort of project. And that's what I want to talk about. It was called Dark Holy Ground. And it started out as a course, and it was led by three people, two of them ordained ministers and one other person. And I think they had about 12 or 15 other long-term unemployed people took part in the course. And the three people who led it were Peter Keeling, who was the Roman Catholic priest over the border, which means in the old town of Middlesbrough, which is where the old Catholic cathedral was. That's now moved to south of the city. And Robert Gallagher, who was the vicar of Coby Newham, which is a estate on the south of Middlesbrough. And thirdly, Keith Lindsay, who was the coordinator of Respond. And they ran a course and it overwhelmed them. It was amazing what they found in that course. And that must be why somebody said, go and have a chat with Robert Gallagher, which is what I did. And he told me all about what had happened in the course. And I had two conversations with Robert. That's all I don't think I ever saw him again after the second conversation, which were just a week or two apart. But those conversations were a very profound impact on me. And what we learned from Dark Holy Ground has stayed with me over, what is it now, getting on for 40 years. That's the background to it. Robert Gallagher had a particular gift. He was brilliant at listening. He sat, presumably, I wasn't actually on the course, but he sat and he took note of what people said, and he heard the really valuable things that they said. And he ended up with a file full of bits of paper with all these little bits and pieces written on them. So with Peter and Keith, they went to a pub in Gisborough, which is another little town in Langbar, and they spent all evening sorting out these little bits of paper and getting them all into the right order so they could produce this little pamphlet called Dark Holy Ground. And when they'd finished, they looked up from the table and found they were surrounded by other drinkers in the pub who'd been listening into the conversation because it was so fascinating. So that was the birth of this booklet. I'll just say generally what happened on the course and what surprised them, and then we can look at some of the excerpts from the booklet. I think the first thing the course did, and this may sound very prosaic and not terribly interesting, but it's the thing that actually began to transform things. They got everyone on the course, including the three leaders, to share their story. And one of the things about long-term unemployment, you know, and where people have been unemployed for years, and sometimes it's generational, it goes on into the second or third generation, is that people sit around feeling useless, and that they can't see a point in life, and they're just sat and they feel like they're wasting their time. So when they were invited to tell their story, first of all, they were heard. And if we see listening as a gift, maybe being heard is actually an even greater gift. Being heard and knowing that you're being heard. And if you've never really experienced that, or at least not consciously experienced it, it can have a profound effect. And that's what it did. Because they started sharing their stories. And the first thing they observed was, these are so similar. Yeah. We're sat around doing nothing all day, feeling miserable and thinking, it's my fault. There's something the matter with me. And then they went into a room and they found all these other people telling similar stories. So they began to think, well, if it isn't me, where's the problem? What is the problem? And that in itself made a profound difference. And jumping over a whole lot, as the course progressed and they shared more and more, they found they were empowered and started to do things in the community. And some of them said, and only the long-term unemployed can say this, that actually being unemployed in the end was the best thing that ever happened to them. That was the transformation. And we'll revisit that transformation shortly because there's a bit more to it. The other thing they did on the course was they read the Psalms, and they made an amazing discovery about the Psalms. That was songs in what Christians call the Old Testament. But they're also present in the Jewish tradition as well. And they were reading psalms that begin with, out of the depths I cry to thee. And they found that the emotional journey that the psalmists were going through were very similar to theirs. So over 4,000 years and many hundreds of miles apart, they were finding people who were experiencing very similar things that they were, that sense of being of life being pointless and no direction and it was there. So they were discovering that their experience was something that was shared, not just by people in modern, as it was then, 1980s Cleveland, but also across space and time as well. And the one psalm that stands out is Psalm 139, and particularly verse 11. And they read verse 11, which reads, "The darkness with you is no darkness at all. The night is as light as the day. The darkness with you is no darkness at all. The night is as light as the day." And somebody said, "It's still dark. It's still dark. The night is as light as the day." And that transformation I was talking about, where people were able to affirm that unemployment was the best thing that ever happened to them, understand it was still dark. Their material circumstances had not changed. They were still unemployed. They still didn't have much money. They were still stuck in the same housing estates and everything else. Nothing had changed, and yet everything had changed.
I was just listening, so I was taking it all in. And there was a question I was going to ask, but then now I'm thinking, is that the right question to ask after all everything you've shared? So I'll still ask it. What was it about this material? Because you obviously, people can't see you when you're speaking, but I can see you. And you're moving your hands, so I can tell that you're passionate about it and the way that you're telling it as well. What was it about this particular material? And I know it's quite rare, as in there isn't, is it right that there isn't many copies of it, or have you got the only copy, or is there more?
Some other people who lived in Cleveland at the time might have got them with them, but it's not available.
So what was it about this particular story of people sharing their stories of difficult times and then reading these psalms? What was it that emotionally connected with you or made you want to share it today? Because I know you've wanted to share it for a long time. Sorry.
I think part of it is in the title, Dark Holy Ground. And one of the key concepts that Robert told me about was the dark face of God. A lot of religious people, whatever their faith, see their faith as being about joy and celebration and so on. But actually, that isn't always the case. And spirituality can be born out of Matthew Fox, who was a theologian around about the time of the 1980s, called it the via negativa. And there's also a via positiva as well. But the via negativa, the negative road, is something that profoundly influences people. And it's fascinating. As a Methodist local preacher, I sometimes tell the story of John Wesley's conversion. And after many years of struggling, and after he was ordained, he had an experience, which I won't go into, where his heart was strangely warmed. But he didn't feel joy or excitement. And he made a note in his journal the next day that, I wonder why I don't feel joy or excitement, but this is so real to me. And he said, well, often people find God when they lose a loved one, and joy and excitement isn't always appropriate. So it's there and present in so much of our religion. I was trained as a local preacher in the early 1980s. And one of the topics they told us to avoid at all costs was suffering. And I believed that up until my conversation with Robert Gallagher. But then I realised that actually this is the common human ground. And if we can't talk about suffering, and I don't just mean the preacher talking to a congregation, I mean as human beings with one another. If we can't talk about suffering, if we can't dwell in those dark places, what meaning does it have? And so I've taken that forward, and it underlies a lot of my preaching now and my understanding of the Christian faith, and indeed, I'm sure the same sort of things apply to other faiths as well.
Yeah, I think there is in Buddhism, I think they say life is suffering is the key kind of thing that you begin with in terms of moving towards enlightenment. It's like you start with life is suffering and then you go from there, if that makes any sense. So it's definitely not something that you want to skip over in terms of, I think they call it spiritual bypassing, when somebody wants to skip to all the good parts, but doesn't want to sit with the suffering.
Hmm.
There's a quote that I don't know if I'll say it right, but Marianne Williamson said something like, "No true spiritual path gives us any pass on looking at the human suffering, or the suffering of any sentient being." And I do agree with that, because I think what happens is if we focus too much on positive things or success or always wanting things in the outer world, we don't see the people that are right there in front of us who may be suffering in the moment, or you don't see yourself as well. So you might be suffering, but because you've sort of told yourself that, no, I'm not allowed to suffer, I'm going to get on with it, and there's this kind of attitude in the world where we always have to get on with it and just be positive. And whereas I think what they've done is, by sitting with their stories and telling their stories and being with the suffering, that's where the transformation happens often, because you're not trying to push it away.
Mm.
You're seeing it. And that's where truth comes in, because if you think about it, what we're trying to reach a place of truth, really, when we're looking at, you know, wanting to be one with God or anything. And you can't do that if you're sort of pushing away suffering.
Yeah, it's dwelling in the darkness. You know, that God has this dark face, and often we're called to dwell there, and it's a very difficult concept. But one of the things that clouds the issue, and this is something that Robert said to me, is that we tend to think of light as good and dark as bad. But actually, if you think about darkness, it isn't always a bad thing. Loads of really positive stuff happens in the dark. I mean, your heart is beating. I'm pretty sure that your heart has never seen the light of day, and yet it very happily beats away and is a creative heart, if you like,
yeah.
In the darkness. What else? The baby in the womb grows in the darkness and develops in the darkness, and it doesn't need any light. It's quite happily gets on and does it. And most of the time, babies are born as perfect as human beings can be. The seed in the ground, the seed will germinate in the dark. So there's loads of stuff going on all over, particularly in the natural world, in the dark as much as in the light. So we need to abandon that sense of darkness always being negative. I mean, it can be negative. Clearly, it can cause a lot of pain in people's lives. But I think once you grasp and understand that it's not your fault, that really helps. Although it's like a spiral, because you go around it and then you begin to think, well, actually, if I'd noticed that all these other people were experiencing the same thing as I am, I would have known it wasn't my fault. So in that sense, it is my fault. But then, you know, you just keep sort of hovering around it. But once you take that step of away from self-blame, that makes a big difference, particularly if you can do it with other people.
Yeah. So do you want to read from the Dark Holy Ground?
Yes. As I said, I've got three or four there. We'll just see how we go. I want to read this one. I suspect the person who said this was Peter Keeling, the Roman Catholic priest, because I think he saw it from his presbytery. There's folk religion exists here. I went out of the door one night and there was a disturbance. A man appeared with a brick in his hand and was about to throw it when he realised he was in front of the church, which is the old Catholic cathedral. He paused, crossed himself, and then threw the brick. I think it went through the window of the cathedral, actually.
Okay, so I still don't get the story.
Yeah, well, this is the Catholic priest. So it was his church that had the brick through the window. But
why did he throw the brick?
Well, the man? Mm. Well, he probably didn't like the church for some reason.
Okay.
But he crossed himself before he threw it.
Oh.
And this is the folk religion. There's a humorous vein that goes through all of this. All the people who took part, I think, began to see the humour in the situation. Yeah, sometimes you're laughing with one eye and crying with the other eye, but that's how life goes, isn't it? This one I find, and these are certain excerpts that I remember discussing with Robert. Don't necessarily remember what we discussed, but they're the ones that sort of stand out. This one, I don't know who said this. I have a favourite place where if I go during the day, I look towards the woods and it is beautiful. If I go during the night, I look the opposite way over the chemical plant and it is beautiful.
So that's looking at saying that everything has its beauty in it.
Yeah, I think the place was a bridge and he could look one way into the countryside, and then the other way, the chemical works would be ICI Billingham, which was an enormous chemical complex. And that reading actually resonates with me because the house where I lived at the time, when I opened the front door to go out, I knew which way the wind was blowing. Because if it was blowing from the north, it was blowing the delicious scent of the chemical plant, which always smelt a sort of stale, chemically smell. It was bearable, but not really pleasant. And then if the wind was blowing from the south, it was fresh and there was a sense of, obviously, there weren't perfumes from the flowers in the forest or anything like that, but it was a completely different experience.
Did you have another section of it?
This is another one that I discussed with Robert and didn't understand until years later. A man was told to fill the engine of the Land Rover with oil. He looked under the bonnet, and where it said oil, he took out the dipstick and slowly, carefully, without spilling a drop, he poured in the oil. It took him 4 hours. He stayed with it. Now, I didn't know where you put the oil in the engine for years afterwards until I owned a car and knew how to mess about with it. But the dipstick, I don't know how familiar you are with engines, Gemma.
I don't drive, so I'm not familiar.
Well, the dipstick is the thing that you pull out and you can see how much oil there is in the engine. It's just a way of measuring. And obviously, if there's not very much, you need to top it up. But then there's another bit somewhere else where you can open the lid and actually pour the oil in straight away. But obviously, the man in this story didn't realise that. It took him 4 hours to very gently pour the oil through the hole that the dipstick goes in. And it's something about that whole... Well, I told you there's a thread of humour that goes through this. But it's something about the frustration of living in this peculiar place where it's almost as if you, on the one hand, your life is on hold, and on the other hand, therefore, you're being invited to something else. And it's that, I think the word is liminal. It's the point that those, that point in life that this is really all about. And the last one that I marked is just somebody's comment. What is growth about? If it's just for me, is it growth? Others are saying, I feel you've left me behind. I feel inadequate. I feel inferior. Do we grow on our own, or is growth something that we do together?
It's a good question. I'd say, to try and answer it, I mean, I don't know if I'm right, but each person has their own growth path, I suppose. Like, you know how we talk about the Enneagram?
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose each individual has their own growth areas which they need to grow, and we only grow by growing, I suppose, other people trigger or so that trigger either in a positive or a negative sense, our growth, I suppose, because we get to respond. It's by those relationships with other people that we get to see where our areas of growth are. And yeah, I suppose by situations as well, not just people. And yeah, I can relate to that feeling of frustration as well, what they're talking about. And then also finding those moments of stillness and, I guess, God in the suffering, in the sense of, but I don't think you find it in the suffering. I think what happens is the suffering stops for a moment, because there's only so much suffering you can handle as a human being, really. And it's almost like the mind, well, this is my experience of it. I don't know whether they'd agree with me on this, but see if you agree, Chris. But, you know, if you're just experiencing a lot of suffering and then you suddenly have a moment where the mind goes quiet and then there's an opening for a different experience, or just a letting go of the tightness of the suffering mind, basically. My mic's falling over again. Where you just, I mean, that happened earlier, actually, when it just, my mic would kept falling over and I was just frustrated. But then I just kind of gave up, not gave up, but just let my emotions come. And then by allowing the emotions to come and realizing you're upset, there's a sort of letting go and just going, okay, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why this is happening, but it is, you know. And then I got the idea of, oh, well, I need to get a new mic stand and just search. You know, it's not as complicated as you think it is. I think sometimes the suffering makes it more complicated because you're in an identity that carries on for years, yeah. Or, you know.
Yeah, I think the key for the people who were involved in the Dark Holy Ground course was finding that solidarity with others, not just the people in the room, but also the psalmists, you know, that and that sense that it's not my fault, I'm not alone. Mm-hmm. Many people are experiencing what I'm experiencing and have experienced similar things over, well, millennia. It's, you know, we're all a part of that, and I think something happens then in the heart where the darkness is still present, becomes something that it's not just living with it; it's celebrating it. It becomes something tangible that you don't want to give up in a positive way. it's very difficult to explain.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm there in terms of the, because even as you're saying it, like, I kind of have this sense of, I feel like that's the first step, is the solidarity, the understanding that it's not your fault, connecting with other people. It's a brilliant moment, and it's a brilliant way of, I mean, I've had it over and over again where, you know, I've been going through certain things and I'll talk to them, even talk to you about it or talk to someone else about it. And I do understand that, that solidarity or that sense of not being alone and how that helps. I just feel like there's another step, like even with this group, and I'm kind of thinking, yeah, it's not their fault. It's great that they had solidarity, but then there's this other thing in me where it's like, there must be another way where this doesn't happen to people. And I think that's maybe where me and you differ, in the sense of,
well, no,
I don't know, maybe not differ, but
don't forget, this was one course run by Respond.
Yeah, I'm not putting it down. I think it's amazing.
And what we were doing at the time, I'm sort of staying in Cleveland.
Yeah.
What we were doing at the time was finding all, there were all sorts of things that we did. I'll just give you one example, and that was Cleveland's experimental area. And they produce a document, and this came from unemployed people. But they produced a document with all sorts of ideas for experimental projects that could be done in the county to alleviate unemployment. And that went to the church leaders. The church leaders, I'm not sure what church leaders do, but they rubber stamped it or blessed it or whatever they did. And then it went to Michael Heseltine, who at the time was the Minister for Regeneration in Margaret Thatcher's government. And he actually visited the church leaders, but the church leaders then did a nifty sidestep and put the unemployed people in the room. And they had a conversation. So it wasn't only about sort of nursing the darkness. There was a lot going on. And indeed, all the woodwork shops and all of those things were all opportunities for people to...
Also, I just want... Oh, sorry, finish your sentence.
For people to find solidarity and community.
Thank you for clarifying. I also want to say, when I said that this doesn't happen again, I don't mean that no one's ever unemployed again, because that it's going, you know, people are going to be employed sometimes, not employed. That's not the issue, really. It's more about the long-term suffering of people because of their status in society. Mm. Does that make sense? So when I say, how can we make this not happen again, it's more about how society as a whole treats each other or sees themselves as well, like how we see ourselves, see each other, which I guess in a way, what you're saying about that solidarity does help a lot when it comes to seeing yourself as the same as others, or in a similar situation, if you're in that situation.
Who do you listen to? That's the, you know, I was talking about listening as a gift and being heard as a gift, and the key for us at that time was opening up possibilities for long-term unemployed people to actually be heard. And that was important. And I know that, I mean, obviously, I left Cleveland in the very late 1989, but up to that point, many people who... And Dart Hurley Ground was only, there were a few other similar things went on after this particular course. Many of the people were finding a personal purpose as well as that sort of wider solidarity. And it's that sharing that is so important. I saw Robert Gallagher for a second time. And the main thing that I remember us discussing was Robert was telling me about his church council meetings. And his church council meetings would start at the usual time of about 7:30. And some of them were finishing at 1 o'clock in the morning, because they were getting so deep into listening to one another. I suppose it became sort of addictive. But he said, because his gift was listening, he was able, I suppose, to pass on the gift of being heard. And he asked me this question. He says, when I listen to someone who tells me their story, and it's a story of utmost despair, frustration, a life of seeming pointlessness, how do you think I feel? And I said, I hadn't got a clue, so I said, I don't know. And he said, I'll tell you how I feel. The emotion that I feel is joy, because it's at that point where someone is at the very bottom, in the darkest places, that I feel closest to God. Now, I think this is really shocking, that there he is, a privileged man, a parish priest, and experiencing joy when he hears people's darkest stories. On the other hand, maybe that joy is important both for him and the person he's listening to. That was, in many ways, the thing that I walked away with. Because I have occasionally been told off for not communicating joy in my services. But where does it come from? You know, you can't artificially generate it.
Are you asking me that question?
Well, I was rather hoping you might say something.
I mean, I don't know if I'd have used the word joy, but I do understand what he's saying in terms of you, because obviously I coach people and you coach people, so you know that feeling where, or even if you're just talking to a friend and they're sharing something that's quite dark or difficult for them, the fact that you're able to listen to them and they trust you, and that they're offering up something that's causing them suffering. Again, I don't know if I'd use the word joy, just because when the word joy, it sort of, when I think about it, I sort of picture my happiest moments of dancing and singing and connecting with other people, but having a laugh or something. But I think there is something that, I don't know if I'd call it more maybe love or connection or appreciation or something like that.
Yeah,
I get where he's coming.
It's outrageous, but there is something about it. I mean, obviously, he didn't sort of get up and start dancing and singing, but it's the dark face of God again. It's the dwelling in darkness. You're not on your own. There is that presence.
Well,
and to be invited into that space,
yeah,
which might feel absolutely desolate to the person who's telling the story, but to be invited into that space is a privilege.
Yeah, I think, well, words again are probably a hindrance sometimes to understanding, because even as you're saying certain words, I want to sort of go, well, that's not how I would say it, just because of this, that and the other. So for example, like when you're saying the dark face of God, I understand what you're saying, but I wouldn't use those words, because to me that confuses my, it doesn't confuse my mind when you say it, because I understand. And this is why I think we need to go deeper than words when we're listening. So when we're listening to another person, they have a different reference point for words sometimes, like this preacher said about joy, and that's not how I would, you know, relate to joy, but maybe he relates to joy in a different way, in which he would use that word. The same with the dark face of God. Like, for me, that's an oxymoron, if that makes any sense, because to me, but you can find, it's almost like when you're in a dark space, God is there, but it's not that his face, I don't know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, but I get what you're saying in terms of that God is there, whether it's light or dark. And I think that phrase is helpful in that sense.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, I've struggled with all of this.
I just don't want to get into that place where you start to think that, like, God's evil or something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I've struggled with that as well. I think it's really important. Let me just to underline it. The joy was experienced by Robert, the listener. Mm. That's not the emotion necessarily that the person he was speaking to would be experiencing. I think that's and obviously, as someone who was listening and counselling someone in a pastoral sense, then, you know, he would be aware of that and would have acted appropriately. But there is still something in there really important about the presence of God. And you said it, you know, that God's there all the time anyway.
Well, yeah, that's how I would feel it, is that the reason why we feel God more sometimes in those moments of suffering, it's not because God is trying to make you suffer or anything like that. It's more that there's often an opening, like a surrender, that happens when you're going through extreme suffering. There has to be a moment where your mind just goes, I can't take this anymore. I'm just going to stop thinking, is what I'm saying. And when that happens, or surrender in terms of, I'm going to share my story, I'm going to tell someone, it's a bit like the 12 steps, you know, part of that is telling someone. Yes. I think, I don't know if it's the fifth or sixth step or something, where you tell someone what you've done, or, you know, what you've gone through. And there's something about that offering. So it's not the suffering that is God. It's more that it's when you offer up your suffering to a higher power, where you say, and that could be another person as well. Or that's, you know, if you're talking to a priest, you're giving your suffering to somebody else in that moment. You're not giving them the suffering, but you're saying, look, I can't handle this anymore. I want to take away this burden, and I want to experience something different. But when you say experience something different, that doesn't necessarily mean it changes the external circumstances, but in terms of your mind, experiences a different perspective.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for that. I think that term, the dark face of God, was something that came out of the dark holy ground. And it was something.
I think it makes sense within that context.
Yes. And I think it also makes sense in other contexts. And it's really getting the idea out there that there's more to this God idea than you might think. You know, all the glib reasons why we're not supposed to believe in God, because why would God allow evil in the world if he was perfect? All of that stuff. It's rationalizations. And ultimately, it comes down to our experience. And that point when suddenly you think, oh, actually, that is God. Oh, right. Now what am I going to do? So just to bring it to an end, just one last thing. I wrote these meetings with Robert Gallagher up into articles for the Teesside Advertiser, sent them in, And out of all the articles I wrote, they accepted every single one except the Dark Holy Ground articles. So, there we go. I don't know what sense you make out of that.
Well, thank you for sharing with us. And yeah, I'm really grateful for the conversations that we've had around that. And I'm grateful for everything that you've taught me around the Dark Holy Ground, but also just things in general. Thanks, Chris. And where can people find more of your work?
Probably best to visit my website, and the link's in the show notes for that. And I shall be revising it over the next few months with lots of exciting new things in it. In it as soon as I've worked out what they are.
And if people want to share their stories as well.
Oh, yes. I'm always looking for people who want to share their stories. If you want to have a go at sharing your story with, particularly for businesses and business owners, I can help you arrange getting a small group of enthusiasts to take your story apart and put it back together again.
And if you would like to find out more about myself, you can follow at Gemma Rosenthal and at Creative Hearts, and listen to my album Extend Love, which is on all music platforms. And also you can have Find Your Voice sessions with me to help you to express yourself more. And if you're running a business, if you need to speak or sing or share more of your true self, then you can have coaching sessions with me. And yeah, we have lots of episodes as well where we have interviewed many entrepreneurs and artists. So make sure you go back and check out the other episodes as well.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gemma. And
thank you, Chris.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.